voices for and you.
Bill McIntosh Show now on with John Paul McIsaac, and he's somebody who you probably recognize, or at least his name you've heard of before, or it does ring a bell, and there's a reason for that, and it's because he was at the center of the October Surprise 2020. It was a legitimate surprise in which Hunter Biden and Joe Biden found themselves in the middle of a scandal involving a laptop that Hunter Biden had brought into John Paul McIsaac's Mac repair store. And that was that in Wilmington, John Paul?
Yep. The Mac shop was located on the backside of the Trolley Square area of Wilmington. So a little bit west of 95.
Okay, good. Sounds like it was like kind of a, you know, a back alley area, you know, just think of a dark light and.
No. You know? It was a cute little like 1980s shopette, like little two-story, bunch of little shops, good places to eat. You know, I miss a lot of, I learned to be a good cook during COVID, so I guess I don't need to go back to that now, but.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me just give people your intro. John Paul McIsaac was born into a military family. As a youth, due to a visual impairment, he found escape in the creation of computer graphics and eventually obtained a job with fixing Macs, as in Macintosh computers, in Delaware schools. He soon realized that he could make a living fixing computers and supporting other creative Mac users. He pursued his creative dreams by filming and archiving airmen from World War II through Vietnam, but fixing Macs computers was his profession. From 2004 to 2010, he worked with Apple in Delaware, building a reputation for quality customer service. In 2010, he left Apple to open his own shop and provide a five-star service and support to the Apple community for nearly 10 years until one day, April 12th, 2019, a fellow by the name of Hunter Biden stumbled into his store, and he became caught up in the Hunter Biden laptop scandal. Now, John Paul McIsaac's life has been changed forever. Thanks for coming on the Bill McIntosh Show. I'm really honored to have you. I just knew this would be a fantastic interview, and I jumped at the chance. And tell us about how the story and what happened.
Well, I mean, you got the cliff notes for it. Hunter walked into my shop with three MacBook Pros, and the one was a write-off. The other one, I actually gave him a keyboard so he could facilitate his own backup. I kind of felt bad for the guy because on one of the laptops, he had a Beau Biden Foundation sticker. So I assumed that these were his recently deceased brother's laptops, and he was just trying to get the memories off of them. And so I checked, I was able to check one in and perform the data recovery. That's when I realized that this wasn't his deceased brother's laptop, that the amount of homemade porn on the computer kind of clued me in that this was his personal device. I didn't think much of it. I performed the job that I was assigned. He never came back in to pay for it or pick it up. And about 2 weeks later, his father announced his candidacy for presidency. So I was nervous because I just assumed that there was going to be a knock on the door. The Secret Service was going to come in and sweep this thing under the carpet, and including me. So I, towards the end of the summer, I reached out to my father, who's a retired colonel in the Air Force, and enlisted his help because I knew I had to, from what I had seen on the laptop, I knew that there was criminal activity. And I knew that somebody was going to come looking for this, and they were going to come after me for what I had seen. Hunter was in possession of a piece of paper that gave me permission to look at the devices and recover data from them. And I can only imagine that a Secret Service agent would see that and just immediately go to Joe and say, Houston, we have a problem. So I trusted the FBI enough that this was the proper way that it should be handled. This was criminal activity. It had to be handed over to the authorities. I just didn't trust the local FBI. So I enlisted my father to reach out to the Albuquerque FBI. He did, and they slammed the door in his face. They told him to lawyer up and get out and not talk about what he talked about. So we tried to give him a copy of the drive then. They refused it. About a month later, they approached my father again, but this time looking for me. And then they made contact with me. They came to my house. I tried to give them the laptop again. They refused. Finally, December 9th.
They refused.
Yeah. And then finally, December 9th, they came into the shop with a subpoena and they took everything. But not before letting me know that nothing ever happens to anybody that doesn't talk about these kind of things. So I view that as a thinly veiled threat. And some other behaviors, they continue to enlist my help to access the drive and the laptop after they took possession of it, which made me really nervous because I had just assumed that this thing would have been put into an evidence envelope and mailed to a lab somewhere outside of DC for an analysis. And I was helping them access the drive in an office building somewhere in Wilmington. So it really wasn't until the impeachment trial that I realized that the FBI had absolutely no intention of submitting this evidence to the White House for their defense. And if they had no intention on acting on the evidence on that laptop, then they probably had no intention on keeping me safe. So now I had a bigger problem. Now the FBI, which appeared to be politically motivated, now knew that I was in possession of this. So I sent my father and my uncle to Congress to knock on the doors of several members of Congress to get their attention. Unfortunately, with the hype of all the Russian disinformation out there, people just ignored our calls for help. And it wasn't until August of 2020 that I finally decided to grow a pair and step out from the shadows. And I reached out directly to Rudy Giuliani's office and offered them a copy of the drive.
Wow. So let me just get this straight. Going back, I do want to talk about the... Okay, great. Well, I do want to talk about the how the FBI intimidated you as they're able to do lots of Americans. And also, didn't it happen that you, after Hunter came in, didn't the day after, didn't you call him mm-hmm. or try to reach him?
Yeah, it was... I performed the data recovery the following day. So he dropped it off Friday. I performed the data recovery on Saturday. I'm closed Sunday and Monday. So I reached out to him on Tuesday, I believe the 16th, to let him know he needed to drop off a hard drive so that I could transfer everything that I recovered back to an external hard drive in his possession. Sure. He showed up that evening and dropped off a drive. He was in about the same condition that he was in when he dropped off the computers in the first place. So I took the drive. He also asked me to pay him when the job was complete. So when the job was complete, I called him. I sent a secure Square payment request. Automated payment request was sent to his email. I got no response. I made several other attempts to get a hold of him over a course of the early summer and never responded.
How many times did you contact and reach out just to get, hey, just to, you know, finish the transaction? I did my job. Let me give you the hard drive. Let me give you your equipment, and you know, you give me the money. How many times did you try to reach out to Hunter to make that happen?
I can't remember the exact number. I know that at the end of the month, I need to collect on bills, so I call every customer that's identified as what's called ready for pickup. Which Hunter's repair was classified as ready for pickup. So at the end of the month, I kind of want to cash out so I can feed the bank and make it through the next month. So I made an attempt at the end of the month then, and probably the end of the month in May.
Maybe four or five times?
Yeah, four or five times, easy.
Wow. So just let me ask you about the first encounter, of the strange kind with Hunter. Hunter comes in. Tell us about that. Bring us back to some of the particulars.
Yeah, you know, I always kind of get a little upset when customers decide at the last minute to show up, because I'm trying to put myself in their position. Like, what kind of customer service are they expecting to get when it's Friday night and a guy's like climbing the walls to get out? And a guy who's very single is trying to climb the walls and get out. So when he showed up, I kind of was just like rolled my eyes, or I think I stopped myself from rolling my eyes because he staggered in. He definitely had a balance problem. The laptop slid from his arms onto the counter, and which kind of clued me in on his care level when it came to his technology. And then when I asked him who he was, when I entered him into the system.
The last 24 months have seen an unprecedented assault on our nation, our economy, our freedoms, our elections, and upon truth itself. So how is it that the enemies of freedom have done this? Well, they can thank the mainstream media and big business who've subjected us to this outrage, and also subjected RFK Jr.'s best-selling, truth-telling book, The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health, to a media and retail blackout. The publishers have turned to us and sponsored the Freedom First Network for help to fight the media's assault on truth. So now we enlist your help as followers of the Freedom First Network and ask you to buy The Real Anthony Fauci. Find the trackable link below in the article that gives us credit for your purchase and your commitment to truth. So buy this book today and buy a copy for a friend or family member. Join in the fight against this unprecedented assault on our way of life with a book that will educate you and others to be effective activists to defeat this totalitarian tyranny. The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, The Global War on Democracy and Public Health. Get this book and buy it with the link below. Thank you, and God bless America.
Because I'm visually impaired. I can see about 4 to 8 inches clear enough to do my work, and I can see about 4 to 8 feet to move around, but not, I can't really see that clearly after a couple feet. So I didn't know who he was. Plus, I don't care enough about the Bidens to know what Hunter Biden looked like. So it just, I didn't care.
Yeah, it wasn't on your radar.
Yeah, it wasn't, absolutely. So when I asked him who he was, he goes, my first name, and he says Hunter. And I said second, last name, and he's kind of paused and kind of sarcastically responded, Biden. And I was just like, okay, oh, all right, Bo Biden. Now I put it all together. I'm a pretty quick one. So yeah. He was in about the same condition that he came in the next day. So I know his phone works because he responded and came back in. I don't know what happened after that.
And he reeked of alcohol, yeah. I guess.
So
one of those things. Mm. Okay. Well, you know, it's not against the law to have a drink now and then.
No, and when I left the shop, because I forget how long I was there. I think I was there for about an hour getting everything set up and closing down. And when I left, he was still parked out in front. So I just assumed that he was sleeping one off.
Wow. So, okay. Okay, great. So then just looking at the timeline a little bit, John Paul, you know, it got into your possession because he needed it fixed. Tell us, so the three laptops, one was a total loss, mm-hmm. right? You couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah, it was gone.
One was not really that hard to recover with because he just needed a keyboard.
Yeah, he had, had some unresponsive keys, so he couldn't actually enter in his password. So I said, hey, here's a keyboard. You can use it. You know what your password is. Actually, I tried to enter in his password. He informed me of what his password was. And I didn't feel, I had a hard time understanding him. So I didn't want to go back and forth too much. So I just handed him the keyboard and said, you can type in that password yourself.
Kind of a complicated password or?
No, a rather simple one, not too many syllables, but just something that you don't want to have a back and forth conversation over.
Yeah, well, the guy's a little testy and don't you know who I am? You know, that type of mindset. Okay. Right. So then, when did you realize that you were dealing with something here that was disturbing beyond just like, you know, some inappropriate photos of him in bed with a crack pipe or things like that, or, you know, girls and photographs that look a little bit obscene. I mean, when did you start to realize that there was a problem here? Criminal activity.
I'd seen stuff on computers before. I have been doing this a long time, and it's kind of an occupational hazard to bump into somebody's porn collection. This was excessive when it comes to the quantity. I felt like there was a lot of embarrassing content, and that, you know, just like I would do anything to keep my family safe, I can only imagine the Bidens feel the same way. And they would not want that embarrassing material out there. What caught my eye during the initial transfer, besides the porn, was a document that was titled Income. And on it explained the 2013, 2014, and 2015's income, what was taxable. It also had some explanations on Burisma and that we're not going to count this $2.4 million coming in. And it was just kind of, and then discussion of phantom income. And then there was a line that kind of stuck out and it said, obviously you can't survive off of $550,000 a year. So we're going to borrow from one of your shell companies. And I'm thinking to myself, he can't survive on $550,000 a year. Like that's That's a sad thing to hear somebody say. It just was like, wow, that's a lot of money. And it started getting the wheels spinning, like, okay, he's got a lot of personal information on here, a lot of sensitive personal information. Now I'm seeing some documents that don't sit right to me. So I kind of felt like I was sitting on a time bomb. And then his dad announced, and then I felt like my time on this planet is short, because it's just who decides to run for president and doesn't have someone on their staff to manage all their electronic devices, especially when you have a family member that has a track record of behaviors that would be concerning. And yeah, sure. How somebody didn't knock on that door and demand it back, and even knowing that Hunter was in possession of that paperwork, just, it amazes me. And I thought I was on borrowed time for the whole summer.
Wow. So at what point, you know, you see, you have basically an accounts, I guess, receivable on him, and you wanted to be paid by Hunter, and you called him several times. This was in April. Initial contact was April 12th, 2019, right? Mm-hmm. So when did you start to say, dang, I better go to the FBI or something?
Well, about the time, about mid to the end of July, it was in the news, Hunter Biden and Burisma. It was all over the news in the conservative news cycle. And I was getting more and more nervous that not only was I sitting on something that could affect me and my health because somebody might come looking for it, I might actually be sitting on something that's evidence in a criminal investigation. And I guess
big one too.
Yeah.
Not a misdemeanor.
Yeah. At that point, nobody was aware that there's been a criminal investigation into Hunter in 2018. So my assumption was right. And I just knew that there was criminal activity. I knew that if I wanted to get any form of protection or safety, I had to go to the FBI, because that way the FBI would have a paper trail. I handed it over. I would have a phone number. I could call somebody if somebody came looking for it. I was looking for, number one, to get it out of my shop and then have the FBI afford me protection. So I felt like that was what had to be done. And at the end of the summer, that's what we set out to do.
Right, right. So then, at what point did the FBI get intimidating with you? And what exactly did they say?
Well, my father approached the FBI first in Albuquerque. And I want to say this was like October, middle of October, or early first week in October. And he goes to the office, and he's never done this before. He's a career military guy, so he's used to going, following a chain of command, and there's forms you fill out and everything. So he walks up to the reception desk at this FBI field office. He's like, I've never been here before. What do I do? And he fills out paperwork, and he gets to the point where it's like your reason for a visit. And he says, we'll need to know. Something to the extent of we'll need to know only. And so he fills it out, hands it back to the receptionist, and an agent comes back and talks to her. And then she leads him down to one of those rooms where it's divided by a plexiglass. And this agent comes in on the other side, and he's like looking at the paperwork, looks at my father. And again, colonel in the Air Force, 31 years defending this country. And this guy's not even talking to my father, not even mentioning his name. And he's like, well, what's the concern? My father tells him the concern. And he's like, you know, I need to do this for my son. I need to get my son some level of protection. And the FBI agent said something to the extent of, it's up to us to decide that. And he left the room with the paperwork, came back. And I think my father asked him if he wanted a copy of the drive and the FBI and the paperwork, a copy of the signed authorization. The FBI agent said, we'll take the paperwork. We don't want the drive. And then my father was like, well, you have to act on this. And the FBI agent was just like, you know what you need to do? You need to lawyer up and get out of my office. And he kicked him out.
Really? He said, literally said, you need to use those words, lawyer up.
What? Lawyer up, get out of my office and don't talk about this. And so
Wow, it's wonderful. Hey, we were going to the FBI.
Yeah, we were crushed because we didn't know what to do. This was our only course of action. It had never crossed our mind to go to the media or the press because we did not, I wanted to remain anonymous. I wanted to keep my identity a secret, but we didn't want this to turn into something political because we were afraid that this was going to be, you know, people that support Biden would see this as an October surprise, which it turned out to be, but would see it as political slander and then would be swept under the carpet. And we were also afraid that people on the right would capitalize on this and want to run with it and only showcase the sensational things, the porn
drugs.
Yeah, and not necessarily go after the real concern, which was there were breaches of national security.
Right. So so then I have this chronic condition, a frog in my throat that never goes away. So anyway, let me just go through the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the laptop is received April 12th, 2019.
Mm-hmm.
The first Trump impeachment, and this is where it gets really interesting and it gets to be something you can't just walk away from. And that is that Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, is impeached December 18th, 2019. Okay, at that point, had you gone to anybody in the press?
Mm-mm. No, because I still had faith that the FBI was the system that we had to trust. And trust me, because when we were planning to go to the FBI, and I think it was in mid to late September is when the impeachment hearings were announced. So I knew that for me, up until that point, it was like, okay, this is about my personal protection. I needed some kind of safety net, some kind of assurances from the FBI that they would take this, they would act on it, and then they would give me some level of protection. And then that kind of shifted to, wow, this is what is the luck that they're going to try to impeach Donald Trump over a conversation that, from what I've seen on this laptop pertaining to Ukraine, he had every right to grill Zelensky over. I mean, Zelensky was created by Igor Kolomoisky, who was Hunter's business partner. I mean, the roots of this thing go so far back that it goes all the way back to 2014. And I knew that I had to approach the FBI in a nonpartisan way. So I couldn't let them know my concerns about the impeachment. I didn't want to tip my hat to that, but that was a major concern of mine reaching out to the FBI. It was like, this needs to be presented. This is evidence that needs to be presented to the White House so that they can have a defense against this.
Right. It is amazing because what you basically saw was confirmation that there were some serious problems between Joe Biden and possibly involving his son, likely involving his son or obviously involving his son, and Burisma, influencing peddling influence, trafficking influence, and Joe Biden kind of had under his bailiwick the Ukraine. He's sort of like a de facto envoy for Ukraine for the United States government, and so you start to hear all this stuff. You hear about the Vindman. Well, at that time, I don't think they knew who it was that denounced Donald Trump. But it was all based on, contact, a phone call with Zelensky, president of Ukraine. So at what point did you go to speak to Rudy Giuliani? Was it before the impeachment actually went down or what?
No. So when I had my fingers crossed during the impeachment trial. And after the trial, I realized that now the FBI, which obviously is not going to help the president, is going to help the Bidens, is probably not going to help me. So I sent my father and my uncle to knock on members of Congress and to get their attention and alert them. But unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears because, COVID didn't help. The pandemic didn't help. And getting the paranoia of all these people in Congress for being afraid of getting wrapped up in something, getting caught up in another conspiracy, getting hoodwinked or conned or tricked, it caused them to be overly cautious, and they didn't heed my cries for help.
Let me ask you a question. Which members of Congress did you approach, or your father approach?
I don't want to go after any. I don't want to name drop because I've spoken with a couple representatives from those offices since then, and I understand. It seems to be a modus operandi of the left to want to snare as many good people in BS, bogus conspiracy theories, and it ruins and draws down their credibility. And it seems to happen a lot, whether you're looking at voter integrity or COVID. You know, there's all these things that kind of snare these people, and I get it. You know, it's the times we live in, and they have to be overly cautious. And I don't want to fault anybody for being overly cautious during all this. It's what we do now that matters.
Right. Well, you know, it's I think it's a sad commentary on the state of integrity among members of Congress that a citizen and their family can raise concerns about apparent wrongdoing and improprieties, but a member of Congress can't raise the issue, especially when one of the branches of our government at the federal level is under attack. Mm-hmm. So basically Trump was raked over the coals because he expressed concerns about the relationship that Burisma and the Bidens had, and whether there had been actually any wrongdoing to investigate. Mm-hmm. And here it is. He's practically, you know, they've tried to eject him from office over this, mm-hmm. over expressing concerns like you did and your father did. So amazing. So then how did you approach Rudy Giuliani, John Paul?
So towards the middle of the summer, I was getting desperate because I was convinced that the closer we got to November, the more this would be treated as just another disinformation campaign or another October surprise. And I knew I had to do something. I felt at that point in mid-August, I felt like me not doing, because I had looked at the data. I knew names, I knew places, I knew times. I knew that if I approached somebody, I was better armed with information than my father or my uncle. And I knew that if I just kind of grew a pair and stood out from the shadows instead of trying to worry about my identity and protect my place in the community and protect my business, that if I kind of went out on a limb, that I'd have a better opportunity of somebody paying attention. And we tried the Department of Justice, that didn't work. We tried the legislative branch, that didn't work. So I figured the lawyer of the President of the United States was my next best shot. And that's when I reached out, and I want to say it was 22nd of August. I sent an email to Rudy Giuliani's office, and I got a response from Bob Costello the next day. And by the 28th, I overnighted them a drive.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I have to say something. This is just an observation. You're very self-effacing. You weren't looking for grandeur or glory. Mm-hmm. You weren't, you know, looking to contact the National Enquirer about a salacious story. And so as you could have if you wanted to. You were just like, first you wanted to get paid. First you wanted to help the client. You know, mm-hmm. Then you wanted to do the job. Let's face it. Some people and some businesses say, I'm not going to give him a laptop. I'm not going to give him a keyboard. I can do that and like expand the bill a little bit because it's not fixing one laptop. It's fixing two or fixing three. No, you don't want to do that. You want to serve the client. Say, look, you know something, you know, actually you can get onto this one yourself. Here's I'm going to lend you a keyboard, which I guess he never paid you for besides the services you provided or tried to provide and did.
He can keep it.
Yeah, really. Sure. But I mean, see, the point I want to make in all this is that I think actually far from you growing a pair, more like the FBI growing a pair, more like members of Congress growing a pair, more like people in our government growing a pair and just admitting, hey, I think we have some concerns here. This could be evidence and a rich evidence that somebody committed felonies and put into jeopardy national security. So we have to do something with this. But no, I think what the people who needed to actually have courage was not John Paul McIsaac. I think it was more like, or his father and his uncle, more like our government, our national government, that refused to go anywhere with this. I think it's really important that that be said, because you wanted to look, you don't want to bring down a hellacious mess upon yourself. You had a business, you mm-hmm. had good reviews on Yelp, right?
Yeah.
You had very good reviews probably, right? And then after that, that changed. What did it do? Tell me about what you went through, John Paul. After this, at what point did you start to get your father get a threat from the FBI in effect, hey, lawyer up, pal, mm-hmm. and get out of my office? I mean, that's really rude. At what point did the FBI then contact you at some point?
Yeah, so it was quiet for a month. And keep in mind, like, my father by this time was so disenfranchised with this country. He had given 31 years in the defense. And then the one time he needs the bureaucrats' help, and he gets the door slammed in his face. So we were pretty down and we had no idea what we were going to do. And all we knew now was that the FBI knew what I was in possession of. So it was about a month went by before the FBI contacted my father asking to get a hold of me. And that's when I arranged to have them come to my house and talk to them briefly there and tried to get them to take the drive and the computer and the paperwork, and they didn't want to touch it. And then
what did they say to you, John Paul?
Well, they wanted to know what my concerns were. So I told them, I was like, look, there's people that are on this laptop that are foreign and domestic, that are very powerful, that I have a fear for my life, that they would retaliate because of what I know and what I've seen. I think that I didn't want to tip my hat to anything that would show that I was concerned about the impeachment, just because I didn't want this to be political. I didn't want this. I had seen how the FBI had been weaponized during the Mueller investigation. I had seen Roger Stone get assaulted in the morning hours with CNN filming the whole thing. I was not about ready to rub the FBI the wrong way, because I've seen what they were capable of. But you know, they eventually came to my house. They took it, or we talked, I expressed my concerns. Then I shifted to, I just want this out of my shop. I want it out of my shop and out of my life. And I want a phone number I can call if something goes south. And they were like, well, we got to talk to our legal team. We can't make that decision now. And I was like, all right.
Amazing.
Then I got a call a couple of days later saying, you know, we want to come to your shop on the 9th, which I think was a Monday. And
the 9th of what month? What year?
December.
2019?
Yep, 2019. So they said they wanted to come to the shop, bring a tech guy, and make a forensic copy of the laptop. And I kind of said that I don't think they can, because the machine won't stay powered on long enough to do these things. And they were like, it's all right, our tech guy's great, we'll be there on Monday. So I met them at the shop on Monday, and that's when they just showed up, just the two agents that I'd spoken with before, no tech guy. And that's when they handed me a subpoena for the laptop, the hard drive, and the paperwork.
Amazing. You had already gone to them and said, I want to give it to you. They wouldn't take it.
Yeah. Multiple times.
But you know, what does that tell you?
It tells me that they were taking orders from someone.
In other words, they didn't do their job. They should have taken it.
That's obvious. But for me, it tells me that somebody was pulling the strings with this. Somebody was coordinating. They'd collect information, return back, there'd be a delay. What really got me concerned was the interaction in my shop, because I told them, they told me what to tell somebody should somebody come looking for it, and which I thought was normal, except they told me that if somebody comes looking, stall them, tell them that it's in an offsite location, that it's at a reclamation center, and I'll have to go and get it. When I hang up the phone, I'm to call Agent Mike immediately, and he'll arrange to have the laptop returned. And when they said that, that scared me, because I thought this should be in an evidence envelope. This should be somewhere safe. So that was a red flag. I cracked a joke at the end. They told me nothing ever happens to people that don't talk about these things. That was a red flag. Telling me, or 2 weeks later, asking if somebody had been in to ask about the laptop, and then acting surprised when I said no. That was a red flag. But it wasn't until the impeachment trial that I was convinced that the FBI had the Biden's agenda more in line than my safety.
Wow. Okay. Right. And so then bring us to the, you know, to Rudy Giuliani and how that all went down.
Well, I reached out to Bob Costello on the 22nd and he returned my call.
Which month was that? Was that December?
This was now in August. This is August 2020.
Okay.
So right. I reached out to him and he responded. We got on the phone. We chatted for a bit. I voiced my concerns. I told him what I went through with the FBI. He told me that he went through a similar thing with the Department of Justice, where when they came back, him and Rudy came back from the Ukraine on their fact-finding mission, they requested that the Department of Justice open up dozens of subpoenas, and not a single one had been acted on. And that's when Bob Costello introduced me to the term slow walking. And I've used that term quite a lot to describe my interactions with the FBI. A couple phone calls back and forth, and I was just delighted that I was talking to somebody of an authority that was directly associated with the executive branch, that I was, that showed an interest in actually getting their hands on this information and hopefully acting on it. And I knew it was too late to affect the impeachment, but I was hoping that it wasn't too late to get the truth out before the election, not necessarily to change the course of the election. But for me personally, I felt like if Joe won, then my days on this planet were numbered. It was described to me that my name's on, has a checkbox next to it. And if I'm not careful, somebody's going to check off that box. That's why I had to get out of Delaware, to be honest. The death threats were getting so intense.
Well, then you had death threats.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. I jumped ahead.
That's okay. Yeah, it's a great story, man. So you finally realize that somebody gives a damn. It's obviously a huge piece of evidence. It's obviously something that people should be concerned about, but it was only Donald Trump's attorney that was able to recognize this and act on it. Kind of shocking, kind of disappointing. So, and then at some point, did the New York Post contact you? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I really didn't know what Bob and Rudy were up to. They kind of kept me in the loop for a couple things. And of course, they wanted to focus in on China because that obviously the national security concerns. I only really paid attention to Ukraine because it was what was in the news and what I felt like that was the criminality that I had witnessed, besides the rampant drug use and prostitutions. I helped them out, but I really didn't know what they were doing behind the scenes or how they were going to approach it. I just assumed that this was going to be entered in and we'd hear about it at a debate or there would be some press release or something. It wasn't until the weekend before, it was like the Sunday before the New York Post ran the story. So probably, I think like the 10th or the 11th of October.
Yeah, right. 2020.
I'm working in the shop on a Sunday. It's a gloomy day. The lights are out. The blinds are closed. I'm not open on a Sunday. I'm just in there turning screws. And I get a knock on the door and there's a reporter. And I freak out. I had never imagined a reporter knowing who I was and coming to me. And I was completely like just shocked. And then she reassured me that this is just a standard procedure. The New York Post, before they write a story, that they're going to send somebody out just to make sure I'm a real human being. And I said, okay. I didn't really want to talk to her very much. It made me incredibly nervous that they were able to find me. I even asked her, I was like, how did you find me on a Sunday? And she's like, I'm a good reporter. And I'm like, all right, fair enough. Good answer. And then, and so that's all I knew is something was happening. And it really wasn't until October 13th, right before I closed, I got a phone call. And it was a gentleman who introduced himself as George Maseras, who then introduced himself as Hunter Biden's lawyer. And he told me that he thinks his client left the laptop with me sometime in 2017, and which he was about 2 years off. And that if I'm still in possession of it. And I said, I listened to what the FBI told me to say. So I was like, look, it's if we held on to something that long, it's in our offsite location. Give me a day or two to dig it out. Can you send me an email with your contact information and your credentials so that I know that you are allowed to represent the customer? And he agreed. He sent me an email and I hung up the phone. I immediately hung up the phone and called Bob Costello and said, WTF over, what's going on? I have Hunter's lawyer calling me. I'm scared. I mean, Hunter's lawyer made reference to that. He knew where the shop's location was. He said, are you still on the backside of trolley? So now I'm scared. Like, this guy knows where I live. Who else knows where I live? So Bob reassured me that everything's going to be okay. The story's coming out tomorrow. Just go home, get a good night's sleep. Ship's sailed. There's nothing they can do about it, and brace for impact. So I didn't go home that night. I actually went to a friend's house because I just I didn't want to be followed home. I was scared. So
yeah, I don't blame you.
I didn't really sleep that night. At about 6:30 in the morning, the story broke, and I was probably about 15, 20 minutes later, I started getting phone calls and emails. It didn't take long for people to figure out that it was the Mac shop, and I was the proprietor of that business. And I started receiving death threats and hate mail pretty much instantaneously. And then a funny thing happened. About 9 o'clock, I get a phone call from a buddy of mine who's like, dude, you broke the internet. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, it's just complete shutdown, like an iron curtain had descended on Twitter and Facebook, and just all these outlets are just talking about it being a disinformation and an October surprise, and this is all coming out of the Kremlin. And it was like, in a course of 3 hours, every mainstream media and legacy media operation, every branch of social media, all lockstep in time, ran the same story that this was hacked Russian disinformation. And it was just, it's something like that doesn't happen here, and then a phone call gets made and another guy. This was a coordinated effort. They were ready for this. And I watched it unfold. And then that night I needed security because I was getting death threats and it was getting really scary. So I called.
Calling. How did the death threats come in? What did the death threats say? Were they by email, social media?
No, most of them were smart enough not to shoot me an email or leave me a voicemail with the death threats, though there were enough that I had to fill out a terroristic threat report with the Wilmington Police Department. Most of the time, if I answered the phone, they would just tell me to, you know, we're going to kill you, or I hope you fucking die, or, you know, just the things that you would expect angry, upset people to yell at a human being that they want to lash out at. I at first, a lot of these numbers, phone numbers, were coming in from California and New York and places far away. As the day progressed, these phone numbers started coming in from 484 area codes and 856 area codes. 856.
Where are they?
856 is right over the bridge in Jersey, so 20 minutes away. And I started to get really concerned because now these are numbers that I recognize the area code for
nearby.
And this is something that, you know, my hours are published on the website. They know my number. One guy kept calling back in because he kept finding more information about me to let me know where I was and where I like to eat and what street I live on.
Wow.
And it was just this real time doxing, and it was scary, but I didn't know. This went from like, I went to bed one day thinking that my identity was going to be kept a secret. Whistleblowers don't get found out for a while. And no, this was like instant. This was an instantaneous.
Wow. And so just the thing is that really is amazing is, so this all happened after the, or just on the eve of the New York Post story breaking, or just after it broke, or what?
This was after it broke. So this was right. The 14th and the 15th and the 16th were really, it was a battle between people coming in, and people start showing up at the shop without computers. You get a little nervous because why are they there?
And what would they say to you?
They come in the shop. I was with COVID procedures for locking the store and cleanliness. I was kind of back to that, where I was only really letting one or two people in at a time, even though I had the space to seat seven or eight people. I was kind of keeping it afloat because I had a lot of press that would come in and then they'd start to bombard me. And I'd realize that then they're not here to get a Mac fix. So you need to leave. And so when I'd open the door for somebody, I'd open the door and then they come in and then I'd sit them down. I had forgotten to lock the door one night and I had a customer at the counter and these two gentlemen came in and they had masks on and they had hoodies, but it just looked like pandemic wear. And I stopped with my customer. I turned to them and they were still at the door. And I was like, can I help you? And they're like, yeah, we need to get our Mac fixed. And I'm like, okay, where is it? It's in the car. And then they kind of looked at each other and then they looked at the customer and then they looked back at each other and then they left. Or actually, I think I said, I was like, do you need a hand? You know, because they were kind of loitering too long. And they're like, we'll be back. And then they never came back. And I don't know what would have happened if that customer wasn't, the customer that was in the store wasn't there. And trust me.
Reconnoitering. Checking checking out the store.
I figured from now on, I'm going to double check that lock and make sure that nobody's getting in that door without me allowing it. And I couldn't sustain that. So about 3 weeks later, it was just, I had enough of that. And I knew the business was on its death rattle and I had to get out of town.
Were people still giving you, excuse me, John Paul, were people still giving you business at that point? Or was it like?
Yeah, business wasn't too bad initially because social and mainstream media did such a good job of not covering the story at all. Nobody knew. I had customers coming in and they were asking, why is there a cop parked on it? Is everything okay? Or they'd come in the morning and they'd see the piles of dog crap or rotten tomatoes that were thrown at the shop. And they'd ask me like, what happened here? And I'd just be like, it's probably best that you don't worry about it. Because wow. I figured if they didn't know, they probably wouldn't approve of my actions.
The question I want to ask you, and I have read quite a bit about it, but regarding the New York Post story, which I think broke on the 14th of October, a couple of reporters at the New York Post, did they actually mention your shop?
No. And I asked the reporter that visited me that prior Sunday, I was like, please remember, I want my name nowhere near this thing. I'll work with you the best I can, but I can't. This is my house. This is my livelihood. And she agreed. Unfortunately, when they ran the story, they included a copy of the signed authorization that Hunter signed, allowing me to do the work. And in the fine print at the bottom, they forgot to blur out the Mac shop. So people
put it together.
I mean, I'm the Mac shop. I mean, you go online and it's the reviews say John Paul did this and John Paul did that.
So, right, sure. Right, know. It's not a big state.
No,
it's really not a huge city.
No. It didn't take long for people to figure it out.
Right. And so what the amazing thing is that they start this narrative, Russian hack, Russian disinformation campaign to discredit Joe Biden and help Donald Trump right on the eve of the 2020 election, an October surprise. This has the earmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign and et cetera. Well, okay. Well, how's that happen? I mean, anybody who's worth their title of journalist would have immediately gone to the New York Post, read the story, and would have done their due diligence. Didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, they, from the get-go, they would have known that somebody was involved who basically had a computer that Hunter Biden dropped off. That's all.
They were really quick to run with the narrative. I want to figure out who pushed that narrative to them. Who decided to wake up one day and label this whole thing Russian and get them on board? Zuckerberg was in front of Congress, I think on the 25th of October, to explain, and that lovely fellow from Google and Dorsey from Twitter were all dragged before Congress to explain their actions on why the story was being suppressed. And Zuckerberg admitted that it was prior, a couple months earlier, that the FBI had approached Twitter, Google, and Facebook to warn them to be on the lookout for a massive dump of disinformation from a foreign power that's meant to disrupt the election.
And how do you know that? Is that what they actually stated?
Zuckerberg said it in Congress, before Congress.
Wow.
So he said...
amazing.
So now the question I have is, if I sent the drive, if I overnighted that drive on August 28th and to Rudy Giuliani's office, and the following week, the FBI warns Facebook, Twitter, and Google to be on the lookout for a massive document dump. Who had the FISA court? Was it me being spied on, or was it the President of the United States or his lawyer? Because that's the timing on that is very concerning.
Right. And not only that, but I mean, the fact that they go and they participate in creating this bogus story, mm-hmm. that it was a document dump involving foreign interference in the U.S. election, involving disinformation. I mean, amazing.
They knew the narrative before the media knew the narrative, because it's
they gave the media the narrative. The government created a narrative, and so then what happened? The media went with it and didn't do their due diligence.
Yeah,
they're not real reporters.
Yep. No, it was amazing to see how coordinated that effort was. It was scary. In my mind, they've had months to plan it, because they knew that I was trying to push this thing out. They were in possession of that drive since December 9th, 2019. They knew I was actively trying to get it to people's attention. So they had tons of time to plan, to craft a narrative, to be prepared, and to get their minions in lockstep with them.
Right. And so then basically what happened to you was that it was no longer safe for you. Yeah. You were getting harassed, you know, you had to leave the city, you had to leave the state. Tell us about your case against Twitter.
Well, Twitter labeled the material as hacked material, and that was their response for not allowing any of the material to be talked about or spread. So that implied that I was a hacker, and if I was ever going to start up a computer business again, I needed to clear my name of being labeled a hacker, because that's pretty much a death sentence. So I ended up with my lawyer, we put together a lawsuit, and we actually beat Twitter's request to get the case first thrown out. Their response was 230 protection, Section 230 protection.
And which we beat them.
That's where these platforms aren't going to be liable for content that's published and printed on their platforms.
Right.
In this case, nobody had called me a hacker. It was Twitter that wrote the narrative. It was Twitter that implied that it was hacked material without any proof whatsoever. I have a signed document. Hunter gave me his password. I mean, this is the opposite of hacking. I had the most complacent person ever to provide me with the information that I needed. To call it hacked material was a blatant defamation. So we looked like we had a case, and we made it through. There was three attempts for Twitter to have the case thrown out, and we beat all of them until May, when magically our judge was replaced with an Obama appointed judge, and that promptly threw the case out with prejudice and then awarded Twitter the Florida slap statute. So I had to pay back Twitter all their legal fees. So
let me put that into relief. That was a huge amount of money. How much was it?
$175,000.
So they ruined your business. They ruined your livelihood. They made it difficult, if not impossible, for you to resume work fixing Macs, which you spent a tremendous amount of time learning how to do. And then on top of it, to add insult to injury, they make you pay their lawyer fees.
Yeah. Well, this was their effort to set an example. And I get it. You know, you want to make sure nobody ever tries to go against big tech again. You put the smackdown on the last guy that tried. And they did. And it succeeded too. After Twitter, I was like, I had the jam taken out of my donut. I thought I would never have an opportunity to hold these people accountable or defend my actions or explain my situation in a court of law. And that's actually what caused me to try for getting the court of public opinion. And that's what I sat down and I wrote my book in about 6 weeks after my defeat with Twitter. Because
when did that case get thrown out by the Obama?
I think it was thrown out early August. of 2021.
Okay, so then amazing. So I mean, I can't blame it all for wanting to write it. I mean, your life has been ruined, John Paul.
Well, I figure I need to keep fighting, and I need to keep trying to get the truth out. And if I'm not allowed to talk, I was shadow banned on YouTube. So I tried to defend my actions on YouTube by making a series of YouTube videos, and those were pretty much swept under the carpet on YouTube. So the platforms and tools and resources that were available to me weren't working with me to get this story out. And that's why I figured, well, you know what? I'll write a book, because they can't stop me from putting my pen to paper. And if I can find a publisher that will publish it, then there might be an opportunity still left for me to get this story out and to clear my name. And that's what I did. And it was a bumpy ride, but I was able to finally, and actually Miranda Devine, I was able to get a hold of her, and she wrote The Laptop from Hell. And with her help, I was able to get in front of her publisher. And then I got a book deal. So hopefully
good for you.
It's coming out, and sooner than November 22nd, we're fingers crossed on that. Apparently we don't make paper in this country too much anymore. So there's some supply chain issues.
Right.
But I'm just excited that I can use that as a platform to try to just get the truth out, because, you know, they've taken so much away from me. I have not much left, and except for my will to fight. And the more they take away, or the more they try, the greater that will is. And I the book and coming on your show and other shows, I'm not going to quit. I told Bob Costello right before I mailed him the drive. I was like, look, you know what? Thank you for helping me. If this thing goes south, if I get leaked and my information gets out there, I run the risk of losing everything. And I would be okay with that. Just promise me that there's going to be justice. And, you know, it's now justice looks like just making sure the rest of the country, the entire country knows.
Here's the story.
Yeah. That here's what happened. Here's the collusion that took place to bury it. And this was performed by media that we trust, big tech that we rely on hourly. I mean, how many people do you know that are glued to their devices? There was a Pew poll that said something like 84% of Americans get their news through digital devices. And if that news is put through a filter that prefers a certain optic or a certain narrative, I mean, we can't trust these. We have to look at these companies with more scrutiny. And we have to hold them accountable for their past actions. And more importantly, we got to make sure they don't pull this again, not on any other American.
Yeah, it's so appalling. I mean, you know, there's something I want to also mention is your father worked at Dover Air Force Base. Dover Air Force Base, isn't that the Air Force Base where members of our armed forces who have died in battle are flown for a solemn military reception? So we saw all these armed forces come back and had gave their lives for this country. And then we see the feckless, uncouth, immoral, lacking in integrity, unethical U.S. government and members of our Justice Department and members of the media absolutely being beyond negligent, acting badly, acting in a way with malfeasance, as Miranda Devine says, not doing their job. And no wonder our government and our country is up for grabs. And it's in not only decline, but it's in major moral crisis and in slow motion collapse, I think. Folks, the book is called American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth. American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth by John Paul McIsaac. Wow, John Paul, Godspeed to you. I hope you sell a million copies, and at least the American people give back to you what the system, big tech, the government took away.
Well, I think I've been blessed right now with an opportunity that I can take these things back. I never thought that I would have an opportunity to defend my actions or hold those accountable in a court of law until last April, when Joe Flynn, who's General Flynn's brother, approached my lawyer, and he's the CEO of the America Project, and they wanted to sponsor some lawsuits. And we had been itching to go after Adam Schiff for a while and hold him accountable for his actions. But we just, Twitter had just exhausted me financially. So now I have a second chance with the America Project to seek justice and to hold these people accountable. And again, you know, sure, I want to clear my name. At this point, you know, it'd be nice not to be associated as a traitor and have the Mac Isaac name go down in history, not associated with this. I still want something better. But what's important and what I want everybody to understand is that this lawsuit is to get to the bottom of who gave these marching orders, who told the 51 intelligence members of our community to pen a letter in the first place, who told the FBI to spread the rumor with social media that this was Russian disinformation. We need to get to the bottom of this so this doesn't happen again. And I'm fine with, I don't want to say leading that fight, but being a hood ornament for it. I mean, if I can get my foot in the door for discovery, you know, people are, I'm sure some of these individuals that we're going after are going to want to settle out of court, but I just want to let them know that I'm not going to settle until we get to the bottom of this. And they took away my job and they took away my place in my community. And I'm not going to quit fighting because sure, they put me in the corner.
Well, the thing is about it, here's what it all amounts to. It amounts to a country where it's not, and no longer by the people. And it's no longer a country where the government serves the people and is accountable to the people. Are we citizens or subjects? It looks like we're subjects now to their abusive, clumsy, destructive behavior. And it's unacceptable. And I want to do my part to, you know, get your story out. So anyway, listen, John Paul, thank you so much for being on the Bill McIntosh Show.
Absolute pleasure.
I think you've done a lot for our country and taking up this very unpopular uphill fight. It's something that if more Americans were willing to do what you did in government, in the media, in law enforcement, then our country would be much, much better off than it is. And unfortunately, we have a country that has a lot of scoundrels in it. Mm-hmm. And they need to be brought to justice. They need to be brought to account for the evil they've done against so many people. You represent millions of Americans who are beaten down and mistreated by an establishment that is abusive. That's all I want to say. And that's the truth of it. And whether it's in the military, whether it's in business, whether it's in education, whether it's people large or small, for the most part, humble people that are just trying to make a living. And it really burns me to see this happen. So anyway, John Paul, thanks a million for being on the Bill McIntosh Show.
Thank you, sir.